Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 17th of June, these are our main stories. A man's been found guilty of the deadliest ever attack against Jews in the United States at a synagogue in Pittsburgh in 2018. President Zelensky of Ukraine has told visiting African leaders that he doesn't understand what can be gained from their planned trip to Moscow on Saturday. The UN's call for urgent action to prevent migrants drowning at sea after questions were raised about the role of the Greek authorities in the sinking of an overloaded boat. Also in this podcast, the search for Wilson, the rescue dog, who's a national hero in Colombia. It was the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in US history. A gunman opened fire in a Pittsburgh synagogue in 2018, killing 11 people. Now, a jury in the US state of Pennsylvania has found 50-year-old truck driver Robert Bowers guilty of the crime. The conviction means he could be sentenced to death, and the sentencing phase of the trial will now begin. After the verdict, Joe Recht, the president of the congregation at the synagogue, spoke to reporters.
I am feeling a sense of relief that after 4.5 years, the world has heard again about the horrific acts on October 27, 2018, and the shooter is being held accountable for those awful acts.
Our correspondent in the US, Neda Torfik, told me more about the charges against Robert Bowers.
He was facing some very serious federal charges, 63 in total. It included 11 counts of obstructing the exercise of religious beliefs resulting in death. That is one of the categories that can amount to a death penalty. He was also found guilty on 11 counts of willfully causing bodily injury because of actual or perceived religion resulting in death. And then counts in regard to him using a firearm to commit murder. He was armed with an AR-15 semi-automatic assault rifle and 3 Glock handguns. And at the scene, he was arrested after a gunfight with police. And at that point, this is when the prosecution throughout this trial really started to detail not just what happened that day, but his history of anti-Semitic and white supremacist posts online.
Tell me more about what the trial was like and who we heard from.
Yeah, this was a nearly 3-week trial. We heard from eyewitnesses there because, remember, along with the 11 Jewish worshippers, elderly worshippers who were killed, there were a number of people who were injured. We heard, for example, from one woman, Andrea Wedner, who was there with her 97-year-old mother, Rose, who was ultimately killed. And she talked about the terror they felt. She said it was indescribable that they thought they were going to die. There was a rabbi who locked himself in the bathroom as he called emergency responders and talked about how he was afraid that Robert Bowers would hear him. And the jury saw images, a prayer book that had a gunshot through it, a Torah that survived the Holocaust. So combined with that kind of very moving testimony from eyewitnesses, from police officers who were there on the scene, and seeing posts by Robert Bowers where he described Jewish people as enemy number one, they put all of this together, the jury, and found him guilty of these incredibly serious hate crimes.
And we're now into the sentencing phase. As I mentioned, the death penalty is a possibility here.
That's exactly right. In fact, when this happened during the presidency of Donald Trump, he actually called for the death penalty. It's something that's been extremely rare under the Biden administration. And the jury would have to find unanimously that he should be sentenced to death. I think one of the things that will come up, they're going to try to, his defense lawyer, say he has a history of mental health. That could be one of the mitigating factors that could help him in that trial. But the jury will be poring over evidence, again, hearing about the seriousness of what happened to determine if he should face that death penalty.
our correspondent Neda Torfik. Staying in the US, the Justice Department has published a highly critical report into policing in Minneapolis. The investigation was commissioned after the death in the month of May 2 years ago of George Floyd, a black man who was killed by a white police officer. The report says the city's police routinely used excessive force and discriminated against black people and Native Americans. Here's our North America correspondent, Jessica Parker.
This is the result of a 2-year investigation by the Department of Justice, and the findings are scathing. It identifies a pattern of unnecessarily excessive or even deadly force by police, including the use of firearms, tasers, pepper spray, and neck restraints. George Floyd died after an officer, who was later convicted of murder, kneeled on his neck for several minutes when he'd already been handcuffed. The US Attorney General Merrick Garland told a news conference what happened to Mr. Floyd was not an isolated incident.
The patterns and practices we observed made what happened to George Floyd possible. As one city leader told us, quote, "These systemic issues didn't just occur on May 25th, 2020. There were instances like that that were being reported by the community long before that."
Among the examples of unreasonable force, the report says that a Minneapolis officer shot and killed an unarmed woman in 2017 who is said to have spooked him when she approached his squad car. But a headline conclusion was the discrimination against black and Native American people. The death of George Floyd sparked protests across the US and beyond, as well as calls for change. The report's recommendations include better training and accountability, with a federal judge set to oversee reforms.
The United Nations has called for urgent action to prevent more migrants drowning at sea. It comes after an overloaded boat sank off the coast of Greece on Wednesday. Nearly 80 people are known to have died. Hundreds more are still missing. Jeremy Lawrence, spokesman for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, said the tragedy showed the need for wider action.
The High Commissioner reiterated his call to states to open up more regular migration channels, enhance responsibility sharing, ensure arrangements for the safe and timely disembarkation of all people rescued at sea, and the establishment of independent monitoring and oversight of migration-related policies and practices.
Meanwhile, pressure is mounting on the Greek authorities to explain how the boat sank. Officials have denied a series of reports that suggest it capsized because a rope was attached by coast guards. Our Europe correspondent Nick Beek is in southern Greece, where survivors have been receiving assistance. He told me there are still contested accounts of what happened.
What we have had today is the Greek authorities once again denying that they acted too slowly. And they've also been responding to this specific criticism that has been talked about, and this has come from at least two survivors, that the Coast Guard tried to tow the migrant boat at some point, and that caused it to sink. We had one official from the government saying that simply wasn't the case, but interestingly, he did say that a Coast Guard vessel had approached the boat and offered help, but that help was not taken. Now, that might not sound hugely significant, but I think it is important because for the past 48 hours, the Coast Guard have been saying that actually they kept quite a distance from this boat. And so the question remains today, you know, why didn't they intervene? And by their own admission, they did have quite a close, up-close look at what was happening.
So the situation remains quite confusing in terms of the accounts. What about how survivors are being looked after?
Yes, well, just over 100 people were rescued in the aftermath of the shipwreck. They were brought ashore to the port where I am now. They have largely been processed, looked after. About 30 people at least were treated for hypothermia, pneumonia. Most of them have now been taken to Athens towards the capital. There was a really moving moment earlier when two brothers were reunited. Mohammed found his young brother who'd originally come from Syria, and we saw them embrace through this fencing. You know, sadly, these are few and far between. And again, 750 people is the figure that people are putting on the number on the boat. We know 100 people were rescued. So, of course, that would leave some 650 people who drowned in the Mediterranean Sea.
And Nick, there have been some arrests.
Yes, there have. We're told about at least 9 arrests. These people will appear in court on Monday, charged with various things linked to human trafficking. There is a word of caution that some critics of the authorities here are saying, in that in the past there have been some arrests for people who were on boats and subsequently they weren't charged. And what some migrant charities are saying is that actually the people, smugglers, who make so much money from this cruel trade, they don't get on the boat, they don't steer it. And actually what happens is that they direct some of the migrants themselves to take the helm, to steer the vessel, even though they may not have any experience at sea. So I think there is some scepticism about those arrests, but certainly the Coast Guard and the authorities here have been wanting to see to take action. And as I say, the legal process will continue at the start of next week.
Nick Beek in southern Greece. President Zelensky has said Russia should be frozen out diplomatically during talks with a group of African leaders in Kyiv on Friday. The delegation will meet the Russian President Vladimir Putin in St. Petersburg on Saturday. A Russian missile strike on Kyiv took place after the South African President Cyril Ramaphosa led the delegation in Ukraine. President Zelensky had this to say.
Unfortunately, today started with yet another Russian terrorist attack against Ukraine. Russia's cruise and ballistic missiles have shown its real attitude to all the efforts to restore peace and to all the leaders of the world trying to protect the world from this aggression. Russia is the only source of war and the only reason why the consequences of this war are causing damage to the whole world, to different nations on different continents.
The war in Ukraine has badly affected living standards across Africa. The conflict has severely restricted the export of grain from Ukraine and fertilizer from Russia, intensifying global food insecurity. Africa, which depends on imports of both, has suffered the most. Here's what Mr. Ramaphosa had to say at the press conference in Kyiv.
We are here to listen both to President Zelensky and we'll be listening to President Putin. And we do so with deep respect for the people of Ukraine, which we have expressed to President Zelensky. And we argue that there must be de-escalation on both sides so that peace can find a way to resolve the problem.
We'll hear from Moscow in a moment. First, our correspondent, Myony Jones, who's in Kyiv, was asked if the African delegation, including Cyril Ramaphosa, who we heard there, was aware of the shelling in the city.
President Ramaphosa replied that he wasn't deterred by hearing shelling in the capital Kyiv during his visit. As a matter of fact, it reinforces his message that both sides need to de-escalate, both sides need to come to the negotiating table, that the solution to an end to this war is not to keep fighting, is to find some sort of compromise. So among the suggestions that he's making and this delegation is making is that perhaps both sides should de-escalate first and foremost, they should respect each other's territories. He said that perhaps Russian troops could pull back and Ukrainians could offer some sort of compromise in return. He says they have a 10-point plan, which is put to Mr. Zelensky, and they're going to put the exact same plan to President Putin. The reality is, Mr. Zelensky says he doesn't see this as a solution at the moment. Diplomacy, diplomatic negotiations, he doesn't think he's going to put an end to this war. He says Russia needs to be frozen out until it liberates Ukrainian territories.
Myony Jones in Ukraine. So as we heard, President Putin is preparing to welcome the African delegation on Saturday. On Friday at an economic forum in St. Petersburg, Mr. Putin was in a combative mood, saying that Western sanctions on Russia have failed to isolate his country and instead have led to an expansion in trade with what he called the markets of the future. Here's our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg.
The St. Petersburg International Economic Forum was Russia's showcase economic event. The Russian Davos, they used to call it.
President Российской Федерации Владимир Путин.
President Putin arrived for his annual speech. No change there. But gone are the Western business executives and Western leaders who once rubbed shoulders with Mr. Putin here. Russia's war in Ukraine and Western sanctions has ended that.
Позитивные макроэкономические тенденции набирают.
Sharing the stage with the president of Algeria, Russia's president made a speech about how well, in his view, Russia's economy is doing. No mention of the war. That came later in a Q&A session. Vladimir Putin claimed that Ukraine would soon have no military equipment of its own left. All its weapons were being brought in from abroad. And you can't fight for long like that, he said. Publicly, at least, President Putin is still confident of victory. He warned that any F-16 US fighter jets given to Ukraine would burn, just like Western tanks have been. If the F-16s are deployed outside Ukraine's borders, but used in combat operations, he added, Russia would consider how and where to hit them. But the most unsettling moment came when President Putin ordered the audience be shown a pre-prepared film about World War II atrocities against Jews by Nazis and Ukrainian collaborators. He used it to try to support his claim that Ukraine today needs denazifying, to back Russia's false narrative that Ukraine is full of Nazis. And all this at what is supposed to be an international economic forum.
Human rights groups in the Sudanese region of West Darfur reporting further ethnic-based killings by Arab militias and the paramilitary rapid support forces. The US State Department says there's credible evidence that the RSF has destroyed entire villages and carried out rapes and murders. Here's our Africa editor, Will Ross.
People fleeing from Sudan into Chad say they've suffered appalling atrocities when attacked by the rapid support forces and Arab militias. At checkpoints on the way to the border, gunmen are extorting money, and human rights activists say there's been widespread sexual violence and killings based on ethnicity. Satellite images show that parts of El Janina city and entire villages in Darfur have been razed to the ground. The US State Department says there's a pattern of targeted ethnic violence against non-Arab populations. In many ways, the violence is a continuation of what happened in Darfur 20 years ago. It's being widely condemned, but no one seems to have any idea how to stop it.
The final leg of sailings, the Ocean Race, got underway on Thursday with a dramatic collision between two of the boats taking part. The event is the sport's greatest round-the-world challenge. And the collision was another demonstration of how tough this contest is, taking the boats around the globe in some of the harshest conditions imaginable. It isn't just a race, though. On their way around the world, breaking multiple speed records, the crews have helped to gather vast amounts of information about the environmental state of the sea. From The Hague, here's Matthew Kenyon.
That's the sound of one of the world's fastest sailing boats powering along at nearly 70 kilometres an hour. The extraordinary sailing machines contesting the Ocean Race make for unlikely research vessels. But as they speed through some of the least accessible parts of the planet, they are also gathering data which is helping shape our understanding of what's happening to the sea.
That's the alarm that goes off when we push the boat too hard, so everyone's awake.
In the frantic days before the boat's departure on the last leg of the race from The Hague, Team Malizia's co-skipper Will Harris gave me a tour of his record-breaking boat. Tucked away in the austere, unforgiving cabin is an instrument box called the Ocean Pack. It records water temperature, salinity, oxygen concentration and much more, and sends the numbers back almost in real time to be fed into global databases, helping researchers with the latest climate modelling, even as the racers themselves tackle the physical challenge of sailing around the world.
Even in the kind of 10 years that I've been racing in offshore and ocean racing, I've already seen changes in the ocean in terms of whether it being more extreme weather events, in terms of seeing more seaweed in the water. There's particular areas in the ocean which is massively over-blooming with seaweed, and to see that in a 10-year period is just, it's pretty eye-opening. That's happening non-stop when we're sailing. So,
two of the Ocean Race boats have the Ocean Pack on board. Two others carry specialist pumps to take water samples, allowing researchers to study the extent of microplastic contamination from the remotest parts of the ocean. Katsia Poborsova is from the UK's National Oceanography Centre. She says it's a chance to get information that would otherwise simply not be available.
It's the opportunity to get to those remote places very quickly, which is astonishing about this whole collaboration between science and non-science community.
And here they come. Let's welcome our first team, 11th Hour Racing Team!
None of the research interrupts the racing, which remains the point of what these sailors are doing. The challenge of travelling at high speed through the ocean is intense and dangerous, as Thursday's collision between race leaders, 11th Hour Racing and Guillaume Environnement showed. Everyone, on board and on shore, is aware of the impact that the race itself can have, and organisers say they've reduced emissions by 75% from the last event 4 years ago. But perhaps the biggest influence they can have is to share what it's like to be out there on the open sea. Here's Team Malizia's Rosalind Cowper.
I've seen all the oceans now. We sailed around the world. And my respect for the nature and my respect for the ocean is grow big time. Without the sea, we cannot live on the earth. It's the lungs of the earth. And I've seen how massive it is and how tiny we are as a person. This is so powerful. We need to protect it because it's worth it.
Rosalind Cowper ending that report by Matthew Kenyon. Still to come?
I had possession of all the Chelsea Manning information before it came out in the press. Julian Assange had conveyed to me as a backup.
The American anti-war campaigner Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers, has died at the age of 92.
At National Bank, we're here to level up your reality.
Does that mean I can move from my parents' basement into my own apartment?
It's possible. We can even help you swap your backyard for a travel destination of your choice.
And if I wanted to buy my first car?
Sure. Let's see what we can do for you. We're here to level up your reality. National Bank.
The Explanation from the BBC World Service takes a deep dive into the big stories affecting our lives, giving you an unvarnished explanation of the world. Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
The Swiss village of Brienz has narrowly escaped being destroyed when a long-expected rockfall thundered down into the valley on Thursday. The mountain above Brienz has been known to be unstable for decades, but this spring, after weeks of heavy rain, the situation became critical and 70 people were evacuated after geologists warned the rockfall was now imminent. Imogen Folkes has more.
Brienz residents had become used to this sound. For months, small rockfalls have been trickling down into their valley. But the unstable mountainside above actually measures 2 million cubic metres. In May, geologists warned a massive rock slide was imminent and ordered an emergency evacuation. For another 4 weeks, the trickle of rock continued, and many villagers became impatient to go home. But overnight, the trickle became a tsunami. Over 1 million cubic metres of rock thundered down. At first light, helicopters checked for damage. Local authority spokesman Christian Gartman had good news.
We were so relieved to see the rockfall didn't quite make it into the village. It stopped just metres from the recycling centre and the schoolhouse. And the boulders are piled up metres high there now. But we're so lucky that it didn't hit the village.
But while the village doesn't appear damaged, it is still not safe for residents to go home. Many tons of unstable rock remain on the mountainside above. Days of geological analysis lie ahead, with the risk still of another rock slide.
Staying in the country, a Swiss cyclist, Gino Maeder, has died a day after falling into a ravine while competing in the Tour of Switzerland. Maeder, who was 26, was involved in a high-speed collision as he raced down the Albula Pass. Here's our correspondent, Andy Swiss.
In a statement, Gino Maeder's team Bahrain Victorious said they were devastated by the loss of an exceptional cyclist. The 26-year-old had been airlifted to hospital after he crashed at high speed on the final descent of yesterday's stage and fell into a ravine. Maeder was one of the sport's most promising riders, having won a stage at the Giro d'Italia in 2021. He also finished as the top young rider at the Vuelta a España in the same year. His death has highlighted the risks of his sport. The world champion Remco Evenepoel described the descent as dangerous and said it wasn't a good decision to have the finish there. Instead of racing today, the cyclists held a minute's silence before riding together en masse in tribute to Maeder. His teammates led them across the finish line under a banner with the message, "We ride for you, Gino," a poignant tribute to a man they described as their shining light.
The streaming service Spotify has ended its podcast deal with Prince Harry and his wife Meghan, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, after they produced just one series. The lucrative deal was signed in 2020 after the couple stopped being so-called working royals. A joint statement said the decision not to renew the contract was mutual. The announcement comes as the prince is also involved in numerous high-profile lawsuits against the British tabloid press, becoming the first royal to give evidence in court for 130 years. And as Guy Lambert reports, the royal couple's podcast had promised to bring different perspectives and voices.
Hi, I'm Meghan, and this is Archetypes.
The opening moments from Series 1. The podcast featuring conversations with celebrity guests.
I'm going to sit down with some of the smartest, funniest, strongest, most passionate women and people I know.
The deal, struck 2.5 years ago between Spotify and the Sussexes production company, was rumoured to be worth around $20 million US. But it yielded just the one series.
Looks, you just popped in.
Hello. Hello. Hello.
The podcast featured star guests, including Paris Hilton, Mindy Kaling, Mariah Carey and Serena Williams.
Am I bringing down to society by saying a woman is something different than ambitious? Or what do I think of women that are ambitious?
And the show won the top podcast prize at the People's Choice Awards in December 2022. But reports suggest Spotify had expected its collaboration with the couple to yield more material. The company has now decided against renewing the show for a second series. The announcement is the latest event in what has been a busy 12 months for the royal couple, with the rollout of their multi-million dollar self-titled documentary series with Netflix.
It's really hard to look back on it now and go, what on earth happened?
The release of Prince Harry's tell-all autobiography titled Spare, and more recently his appearance in court to give evidence in the phone-hacking trial against The Mirror. Spotify has been struggling to make money from podcasts, despite a period of heavy investment, and last week announced it was cutting 200 jobs in its podcast division, saying it was embarking on a strategic realignment. A representative for Meghan Markle was quoted as saying the Duchess planned to continue developing content for the podcast, but on another platform.
The American anti-war campaigner Daniel Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers, has died at the age of 92. He had pancreatic cancer. He was once described as the most dangerous man in America, and later as the first modern high-profile whistleblower. Rob Jones looks back at his life.
Daniel Ellsberg studied at Harvard and Cambridge and enlisted with the US Marines in the 1950s. He went on to work for the State Department and Department of Defense as an analyst. But he became disillusioned with the war in Vietnam, and he would achieve worldwide fame and infamy by leaking classified documents which revealed the decades of lies told about Vietnam by successive governments. While working at the Rand Corporation in 1969, Daniel Ellsberg began photocopying a 7,000-page study of the war, which became known as the Pentagon Papers. It took months. On several occasions, police came to the office where a friend was letting him use the photocopier because the alarm had been accidentally set off. But each time they left without any suspicions being aroused. Ellsberg took his teenage son with him sometimes, as he wanted him to understand his actions when they became public. The analyst said he fully expected to spend the rest of his life in jail. After trying unsuccessfully to get senators to reveal the information from the documents, he gave the papers to the New York Times, which published the first excerpts in 1971. The US government tried to block publication, but lost the case at the Supreme Court. He was charged and tried under the Espionage Act, but a judge dismissed the case in 1973. Daniel Ellsberg became a leading campaigner for transparency and supported other whistleblowers such as Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden and Julian Assange. In a BBC interview in 2022, he revealed he'd been more than just a supporter.
I had possession of all the Chelsea Manning information before it came out in the press. I never said that publicly. Julian Assange had conveyed to me as a backup in case his was, you know, they caught him and they got everything. He could rely on me to find some way to get it out.
Announcing in February 2023 that he had terminal cancer, Daniel Ellsberg said he felt lucky and grateful for the life he'd lived. As I look back, he said, I think there is no greater cause to which I could have dedicated my efforts.
Rob Jones on the life of the American anti-war campaigner Daniel Ellsberg, who's died at the age of 92. Now to a story dominating the TV news in Colombia.
Uno de ellos, Wilson, que recibió entrenamiento en la Escuela de Logística del Ejército Nacional. Wilson, al que todavía estamos buscando y estamos esperando allí.
That's the continued search for Wilson, the rescue dog, who's become a national hero for discovering the four siblings who survived 40 days in the Amazon jungle after a plane crash which killed their mother. The story of the children has been followed by millions of people around the world. The Colombian army says it's now determined to recover the Belgian Shepherd. I've been hearing more from Luis Fajardo from BBC Monitoring, who's in Miami.
Andrew, there's a massive search going on for Wilson. As you said, there are 17 members of the Colombian Special Forces. They're described as the best troops in the Colombian army. They were part of the search mission for the children, and they describe Wilson the dog as a fellow commando, as they call him, and they say that no commando is going to be left behind in the field. So the operation continues. They say they are combing the jungle, for example, with recordings of the trainer of the dog, trying to convince him to show up. They're also dropping food in places where they hope the dog might find it. And of course, the entire country and the entire media is really, really following this story, hoping to have a happy ending to complement the very, very good news that they received a week ago when the children were found alive.
And the status they've given Wilson means that basically they're not going to go home until they found him.
That is exactly what they're saying. They say that nobody is going to be left behind, and that by that they also mean the dog Wilson. So they say that the rescue mission is continuing indefinitely in this very harsh corner of the Colombian Amazon jungle, very far away.
There are loads and loads of memes on social media about Wilson.
Certainly. One of the things that has happened is that the Colombian public has reached the social media to demand, basically, that the dog would not be abandoned. They want to make sure that the happy ending of this story is complete. And they are saying in their social media memes, Wilson, we're sorry for having let you go missing. We will definitely look after you. We'll definitely try to find you. And we're not giving up until we have news from you.
And people everywhere will know this, that sometimes a news story captures the public imagination. That's exactly what's happened with this.
Absolutely. This is such a big story in Colombia. Very big, and definitely a lot of continuous attention on the issue.
Luis Fajardo with me from Miami. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition or the stories we included, drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or we're on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Nick Randell. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
On the count of three, I want everyone in the room to shout the name of the podcast. We want people at home to listen and download. Ready? One, two, three.
Dear Daughter!
That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service with me, Namulanta Kombo. It's a podcast where we share letters with stories and words of wisdom for daughters everywhere. And this is the first of two live shows I'm recording here in my hometown of Nairobi, Kenya. It's the dating special. So in this episode, we'll hear letters all about dating. So you know what to do. Wherever you find your BBC podcast, search for 1, 2, 3.
Dear Daughter!
All right.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.